and welcome to our podcast series, Hidden Growth Champions. Today in our virtual studio, we have Peter Armitage from Anchor Capital. It's a fascinating company, and I've had the privilege of getting to know them, particularly over the past year. Peter, welcome to our studio. Thank you for taking the time to spend with us. Tell us a little bit about yourself and about Anchor Capital.
Oh, thanks, Zog. Great to be here. I'm a chartered accountant, 50 years old, got an investment background, had a passion for equities and markets and making money out of listed markets my whole life, and held various positions, got lots of nice ratings as an analyst in my early days, Deutsche Bank, Merrill Lynch. I was the chief investment officer at Investec, and about 8 years ago started Anchor Capital, which we'd built into the biggest independent wealth manager in South Africa, outside of the ones associated with big banks and insurers. And we're sitting now 8 years later with about 250 people, about $4 billion or 65 billion rand of assets that we manage. And still a young, hungry, passionate business, and in the early stages of our life, the way that we look at it.
That's fantastic. Peter, I've got to take us back kind of to the beginnings of where this all started. I remember one of our global associates told me once that one of the reasons as to why they liked working in their organization is they remember what it was like when it was young. They remember the enthusiasm, the energy, the vibe. And I guess you kind of being on this journey for the past 8 years. Tell us a little bit about that early period. Tell us how it started and how it started growing towards what you've just described to us.
Yeah, I think sitting at Investec, literally one day, I just decided that my future wasn't going to be creating value and doing vanilla things for other people. So I always had an entrepreneurial bent, and literally without a business plan, I resigned and we set off on the journey. And really our game, we don't have physical assets. We don't have factories. We're not selling a physical product to somebody. So it's all about people. And, probably the most fun time in our business was when everybody in the business could fit into a room. So there's no secrets. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing. People can add value just by shouting over the, shouting across the table. And what in South Africa we call chaos, a lot of spirit. And the biggest challenge is once you get bigger than one room, so I think we still had about five or six people in the business after year one, but that's grown into, as I say, 250 people across six offices. And the challenge, an exciting challenge has been to try and keep that spirit and keep the culture. But really I always say to the guys in our business, a business of our kind, a professional services business, is a room full of people with a brand around it. So that brand determines your culture, your definitions, your values. But really, I think the first time we ever sat down and tried to define our culture and work out what we're trying to do was a few years in. And it really becomes a case of defining what you are and what you've become, which is as a result of the ethos of the people and the enthusiasm and hunger of the people. And then trying to bottle that to as the business expands and to try and make sure that you sustain that. And again, you sustain that by having like-minded people. I think also in the early days, the key to our success was people who were hungry and had a kind of sales culture and were very ambitious. So we tended to attract the same kind of people. A few years in, you realize that the person who can run the business well and do the admin and deliver the service is just as important. So one of the things that I've learned over time is what we call complementary teams. So to make sure that you've got all the different aspects of a business figured out. But in the early days, you need to pick up the phone and go and get clients. So that becomes the most important. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, In a way, we've got a kind of just do it attitude. A lot of entrepreneurs tend to backfill, which is kind of what we did. So you get out there, we know we can invest money. The investment backbone of our business is very strong. I come from an investment world. So we were confident in terms of the delivery of investment returns. But then it became a case of going out there and getting clients. And that was probably the most fun in the first 3 years. every new client. You could kind of double your business every few months with a few more clients. And it's been a great joy doing that.
Yeah. Peter, as you were kind of describing this, the kind of confidence and kind of energy and appetite to go and get new clients, knowing that you can deliver, knowing that you can provide a return, knowing that you know, there's something special that you can do together with clients. I certainly got a sense in some of our conversation and interactions I've had with your firm that it's a very much of a customer focused organization. The customer is not kind of an unseen part of the equation. How does that feature into the kind of work that you do? I mean, if I had to describe you as an asset management firm or a wealth management provider, yes. How do you see customer fitting into that equation? Having that on the one side, your energetic, confident, go-getter team. Tell us a little bit about that, the role of the customer.
So I think within a business like ours, what I always say to our people is, if you make people money and you give them returns, that everything looks after itself. You know, if you've got a happy client, you're going to attract more of their funds. They're going to refer you to their friends. And I think a great part of our success has been the referrals from people who are happy. I think going back to, you know, the kind of the bigger organizations, you have to work in those in our game for 10, 20 years to get all the experience and go through the ups and downs. But I think you land up, you know, when the brand gets too big and a company gets too big and there's too many customers, you land up with people, you know, just managing and putting the customer in box A, B, or C, and really protecting, you know, looking after a client in a way that protects their professional career. You know, we've turned it around, and that was one of the reasons that we started the business, is, you know, sitting at the bigger banks, you felt that, you know, clients were literally being put in categories and being given vanilla services. And there was a great opportunity to, from a customer point of view, to create bespoke services, you know, so we don't go to a client and say, you know, you're in tick box ABC, therefore that's right for you. You know, we sit with them, we understand, and bespoke is a big word in our business from a client point of view. So we're not trying to look after our professional careers. We're trying to do the appropriate thing for a client and make sure that the investment solution and the service that we create for them is right for them. So, and that works both ways. You know, in our business, we kind of, in many respects, we're half investment people and half psychologists. So first of all, you've got to understand where a client sits. There's a lot of clients who can't really afford to be big risk takers, but psychologically they are. We've got to pull them back and, you know, give them a more conservative investment that's appropriate for them. You know, and then there's other clients who're so scared about investing and making a 5 or 10% loss that they never expose themselves to the optionality of returns. You know, so to try and convince them to put a small portion of their money in something that might have a little bit more risk. So I guess everything feeds back from the customer, understanding their needs, understanding, or, you know, getting a feel for their future revenue generation potential. And, you know, we then go back to the office and design something around them. So in the early days, we were able to attract, what's been remarkable for me is, you know, we've got about 100 clients who've invested over $10, $15 million with us. You know, that's not their net asset value, just investable assets. Mm. Now, to hand over that sort of investment to somebody else requires an immense amount of trust. And that's trust in the company, it's trust in the brand, trust in the individual that they're dealing with. So I'm very proud that we've got to that level. And you only do that by putting the customer first, providing, and, you know, bear in mind that every single client and every cent that we've got in the assets that we've raised over the course of the last 8 years, you know, it was typically with another investment manager or at another investment house. So we had to provide something different. And I think bespoke is the word that's been the greatest success story.
Now, Peter, from what I understand, one of the kind of aspects of your growth have been in offshore growth as well. So you provide both solutions for local investment as well as outside the borders of the country. And certainly from our work, we're always conscious that geographical expansion, that going into new markets is a fairly risky affair. A lot of the assumptions that we make about how things operate, the way we perceive and make sense of risk, et cetera, those things are often not the same as in your home market. Working in with counterparts could be one way of offsetting that, to understand the local conditions, etc. But give me a sense from your perspective, when you became essentially a window to the world of investment well beyond the borders of the country, how did that change your business, or did it?
Yeah, so I think, just to be clear, we're not sitting with a lot of people outside of South Africa. We're global from the perspective of we invest people's money globally. Yes. So certainly, you know, sitting on the stock market and observing many, many businesses, a lot of South African businesses who physically trying to create businesses offshore, probably more than 50% fail. Often they try and buy businesses, and if they're selling it to South African, it means the locals haven't wanted to buy it. We're in the privileged position of having a global business, but our client base is pretty much all South African. So the focus has been on creating global investment opportunity for South Africans. And I think the next leg of our business, we'd be expanding our London office now, is to create the offering to, you know, people in Europe. But at present, we've, you know, on day one in our business, we started our offshore investment funds. So, you know, the track record of our global investment is as old as the business. That's sitting at about 9 years. And the journey has been to get South Africans into the paradigm, especially in the high net worth space, that they're global citizens. You know, in South Africa, if you've got a really high net worth, your local market, you know, in the case of South Africa, there's no reason that should be more than 10 to 20% of your wealth. So a large portion of our revenue is effectively dollar or euro denominated, but as a function of where people's money is invested, as opposed to the client being an international investor.
Hmm. Now, Peter, I've got to spend some time on this. I mean, you started speaking about the psychology of investing. Now we're talking about a particular aspect of it, which is the paradigm and the mindset, the lens that people use when they think about, in this case, overseas investments. What did you find in your work with clients? How do you change that paradigm? How do you shift people from being very comfortable in their understanding of a particular market, of a horizon of investment opportunities? And now you're coming with something different, maybe something that is less understood, maybe something that they haven't applied their mind to, or maybe something they're even resisting and don't want to look at. How did you find in your work that paradigm shifts?
So a lot of it isn't a day one hit with a client. I think you develop trust and you continue to show them what's possible out there. I think a lot of people have made money out of businesses, but aren't that sophisticated in terms of the investment world. So helping them understand what's achievable, you know, the US equities, you can expect a 9% dollar return over time with some volatility, you know, so breaking that down for them. Why should you expect that? What does it mean? People naturally want to invest in things they're comfortable with. You know, they'd rather have money earning interest with First National Bank because they know it, they can see it, they can go and touch it. And that's why you see a huge investment from high net worth individuals and local property, because it's something that's tangible. It takes all of the fear away from it. But a big part of it is education, showing what's possible. And working with them on a plan with kind of working out what the objectives are and then measuring where they are along the path of that plan and getting people familiar with, you know, the biggest issue with investment in any asset class is, you know, we can guarantee a certain return. The moment you want to get a little bit more of a return, you have to accept a little bit more volatility. You know, so you then go into, you know, not just in the fixed income world, you know, not just government bonds, but corporate bonds. You know, and it's our job, and we've got to get the trust that we're going to put them in the right stuff. In the equity space, you know, equities are such a broad term. We can invest people very conservatively in equities. We can invest them, you know, far more aggressively and take a bit more risk. So it's about giving them the confidence that we're matching their investment profile and objectives with the instruments and what we're creating for them. And then educating them along the way that, you know, if there's a portion of their money that's sitting in equities, it's in traveling the journey with them, helping them to understand and expect that, you know, you can get a five. If you're going for a 50% return over a 4 or 5 year period, along that journey, you can well go down 10% or down 20%, and, you know, not to get too depressed. And the example I love to use, if in a department store, if people are looking at a clothing section and over the microphone, somebody says, you know, the clothes are now 30% off, people are going to buy, you know, rush in and buy all the clothes. On the stock market, if it goes down 30%, everybody wants to rush out the door. So it's to train people and educate them that, you know, to be a buyer when things have come off and to be a seller when they, you know, when they're overvalued. And that's part of our, you know, you talk about the psychology. That's our job to work in the best interests of the client to make sure that they stay the course. And then, you know, we've also, in terms of being, you know, there's 200 asset managers in South Africa. It's not a difficult business to start, but there's probably only 3 or 4 in the last 20 years that have got past that boundary of, you know, 5 or 10 people looking after a few billion rand. And a lot of that is about, you know, working hard and digging and scratching and trying to find those excellent investments. So, you know, the challenge in the investment world at the moment is yields are very low. You know, if you want to, in offshore money, if you're not taking equity risk, it's very difficult to get any return anywhere. So, you know, we always look at problems like that. That's a problem. So how do we solve it? A great yielding investment is property. Given what's happened around the world and everything getting smashed, there's some real bargains and really high quality stuff. You know, so prime London property, we can buy 30% cheaper than 6-7 months ago. So, you know, that stood out, and you know, we can get clients a 6-7% very low risk pound return. So that's attractive. But in the stock markets at the moment, property shares have become almost uninvestable. They've all got huge amounts of debt. And so we sat there and went, okay, there's some very attractive investments out there. Listed instruments aren't the way to get at it. So we've gone and sourced and done due diligences on certain investments, which we can then present to clients to solve that investment issue. And that's just, you know, an example of how we approach it, to say everything is centered around, you know, what we need to give clients certain investment profiles within certain returns and what's the best way to achieve that and the best way to access it. Our defaults and our DNA is the listed market. You know, we like being in things. I always look at shares and the share market as saying I can have every CEO, I can choose to have any CEO in the world working for me by owning their share. And if I don't like what he's doing or I don't like his strategy, I can fire him within 1 minute. You know, so it's a hell of a privilege to be able to invest and have those people working for you. And, you know, that's been the fascination my entire career, is to identify the right companies and the right opportunities. So we've got, you know, on the offshore side, we've got a team of about 12 people working full time on identifying attractive international investment opportunities. And, you know, that's a real passion of ours. And nothing makes us happier and nothing makes a client richer than finding the right company. You know, our equity fund this year, which goes out to fund assets with, you know, kind of multi-bagger potential, businesses that can, you know, not just grow at the kind of 5 to 10%. So there we up about 70% in the last 12 months. And there's nothing like that that creates a spirit in the business and a vibe and an excitement and, you know, gets clients excited about it. then you've got to say, right, the client's made all that money. Do we take a little bit off the table? Because once you've made so much money, typically people want to put more in rather than take it out. You know, there it's our job to say, let's bank a little bit of that. But that's quite client specific. And you know, we look at what proportion of the assets it is, et cetera.
You know, Peter, you've just reminded me one of my favorite authors that talk about solving messy, difficult problems. It's a guy by the name of William Taylor. Among his many pursuits, he was one of the founders of Fast Company. He wrote a number of wonderful books. This particular one is called Simply Brilliant. And he kind of profiles different organizations, high growth organizations that have solved real customer problems that entrenched organization in the industry haven't been able to solve well. And he tries to answer the question, you know, how do we make people change? How do we make people see a different perspective? How do we make them see the opportunity in non-listed versus listed investment? It's just a theoretical or is one example. And he talks about the power of the relationship, that it's not us to change them or that they simply wake up one morning and decide to change. It's the relationship, but it's a trust and what you build together, that common understanding of the problem you're trying to solve and how you could offer something different that changes that. So it's a wonderful read. And as you were kind of describing it, it's very similar to how he describes these messy, difficult problems.
And I think an important point, a part of it, is we go on a journey with a client. And nothing makes me more excited in the office, you know, in a time when, you know, let's say we've had a bad month in markets, you're seeing anxiety on the face of our investors. Of our investment people, the people who are looking after the investors. And, yeah. You know, that shows me how seriously they take in their client's investment. And, you know, we've got to kind of feel the same amount of pain as they're feeling. And that's the danger in our industry. You know, if it's just, and the massive difference between, you know, good people in our industry, you know, in the wealth management space grow, you know, have the best clients and grow huge books. You know, we've got some competitors with hundreds and hundreds of, you know, if you look at the big insurers, they've got thousands of financial advisors, but each doing small amounts of business. And they're really just approaching stuff from a sales point of view. They want to sell a product. If we're interacting with a customer, we're starting a journey with a client and we get excited when they make money and we get anxious when they lose money. And it's, if we ever lose that, then we just become salespeople.
Peter, you probably answered this, but let me ask the question. I'm going to turn to another American author and in this case, investor, Peter Thiel. And I'm really fascinated by this, the psychological aspect, the relationship aspects that follow in investing with clients. And he asks the question, what important truth do you know that very few people agree with you on? So if I had to kind of put it to you, when we speak about the psychology of investing, when we speak about investing with and for people, what important truth have you realized that perhaps few people, people in larger organizations, people in insurance organizations perhaps, do not necessarily agree with you on?
Yeah, so I think the in a business like ours, that's about your investment philosophy. It's about how you believe you should invest and what you should invest in. And where I think, almost bizarrely, we're quite different from certainly most of the South African investors who are investing offshore. And they're very much of a value bias and very happy to invest in bad businesses that are cheap or businesses that aren't growing. You know, our approach to life is, and from an investment point of view, is if you're going to look at a business in your own name to buy, the characteristics that you'd look for and the growth potential, and you know, how do you take it from 100 to 200? And just because something's wrapped in a share, for us, shouldn't change that psychology. You know, we don't want to buy a business that isn't going to grow because it's trading at a 50% discount to its book value. We'd much rather pay a reasonable price for a business where I want to hire that CEO and I know they can compound and grow that over time. So that's kind of at the core of our investment philosophy. And I think the other truth, which people pay lip service to, but but really battle with is, if I observe the creation of wealth over time, it's people who've been able to stay the course and compound earnings over time. That's our property. I remember sitting when I worked at a big bank, probably half of the high net worth clients had made their money out of property. It doesn't blow the lights out, but it's 10% every year. If you compound at 15% per year for 5 years, you've doubled your money. Yes. And people often lose the concept of that compounding out of fear. So they don't stay invested, or they, there's always lots of things to be worried about. If you're sitting with a good business and you've hired a good CEO through owning the share, in a sense, you're trusting them to navigate the course. So that's the kind of core truth and philosophy that we employ, which then informs what we invest in and how we work with the clients. So there's, in the investment game, there's so many people, and there's always people who have similar philosophies and approaches. But I think in the South African context, we're fairly unique in that sense.
Hmm. Peter, if we had to kind of glance our eyes towards the future, we're now starting to emerge from quite a different crisis to the financial crisis we were used to, certainly 2008 one, and I can think of even some of the earlier ones. I'm very conscious that not all markets would recover the same. Not all organizations are going to make the same or as sound decisions. There will be winners and there will be losers. And I kind of wonder when I kind of look at the world map, and you mentioned London is just one particular market that you're operating in. Where do you see the markets that are likely to grow and emerge from this crisis in better shape versus those that would languish for a long period of time? And not suggesting for a moment that there's no investment opportunities there, but I'd love your view on this.
Yeah, okay. So you've got to separate it out into two key aspects. One is territories and the other one is types of businesses. And then also, an important point is where you invested. So if you invest on the US market, it doesn't mean you necessarily invest in the US. And the best example of that and why America's done so much better than Europe from a stock market point of view is virtually all the big tech companies are listed in America. So they've got businesses all over the world. And you aren't just buying the American experience. You can buy a Chinese company listed in the US market. In Europe, you can't really buy tech companies. The tech businesses are all listed in the US. So from a market point of view, you've got to understand that the nature of the companies that are listed on that market have a big influence. So if you invest in the London market, you're investing 50% in banks and oil companies. So it's a type of company. Mm. There's very little tech exposure. So there's money being made in tech in the UK, but you have to invest. If you want to get into that, you have to go to the US market. So first of all, from a territory point of view, the countries that will come out of it well are the countries that have really got a strong enough currency or balance sheet to stimulate the economy out of an economic decline. So unfortunately, a lot of emerging markets, if you look at South Africa, we don't really have the ability or the balance sheet to stimulate the economy. So it's a long, hard road to get back to where you were. So from a territory point of view, and I think certainly China, America have the greatest ability to stimulate. Europe is coming through with some very strong stimulus programs, but they've got kind of structural issues in terms of populations that aren't growing and the lack of investment that the lack of innovation and new products that happen in the likes of China and America. So from a territory point of view, and from a short-term point of view, I think there's quite a lot of opportunity in Europe and the UK. The UK market is still down 20%, whereas the US market is up. But that's largely as a result of tech shares. And as I said, the UK market is banks and oil companies. You then you've got to look at specific companies and industries. And the future of most companies in the world has changed. Particularly the tech future. I remember you know, Microsoft CEO saying that the growth and the trends that they were seeing have accelerated by 2 years in 2 months. Shopify, which is the biggest listed company in Canada, which provides a platform to sell things in e-commerce, you know, they reckon they're not, and that's a big company. They're linking up now with Facebook to do e-commerce. So it's, you know, it's not a dodgy small cap. This is a proper critical mass business. They're saying that they're now doing the turnover that they were predicting to do in 2030. So the future, in a sense, got accelerated dramatically, and people's behaviors, saying has changed forever, I think is, you know, not exactly the right phrase. What I would say is the trend has been accelerated and the change in behavior has been accelerated. So certainly if I look at home, you know, my wife had never bought anything online. My kids were going to the malls. We now literally have a delivery almost every day at our house. So we'll go, you know, they'll start going back to the malls a little bit, but certainly the percentage of sales that's going through the commerce channel has accelerated dramatically. So in the whole COVID and economic meltdown, the tech companies, I think, are 20% more valuable than they were in January because their future's been accelerated. And, you know, the consumer spend is a pie. And if somebody's getting a bigger slice of the pie, somebody else is getting a smaller slice of the pie. So, you know, companies that that were sitting in the old world and didn't adapt quickly enough will be under a lot of pressure. So if you look at the US market at the moment, and if you'd fallen asleep for a year or two and woken up and didn't look at the path of the market, we basically where we started the year, but the journey's been 35% down and then 50% up. But in the tech companies in America, which are about 40% of the market, they're up 20%, and everything else is still down 10 to 15%. So there is some, you know, that gives you a picture of how we're looking at the world. And you know, the challenge now from an investment point of view, the companies that have done very well are quite expensive. And do you stay in, you know, as I said, at the core of our philosophy is we want to invest in businesses that we back. But the nuance in our game is, you know, the greatest business in the world can get too expensive to own. So that's the challenge that we're facing. We've done very well. We've been invested in those tech companies and invested in the companies whose futures have accelerated. But, you know, there's probably a little bit, there's an opportunity, I think, to cash in on some of that. And that's where the psychology comes in, because when somebody's made money out of something, they're not inclined to sell it.
Peter, what do you see Anchor Capital, say, 5 years from now?
So I think when you ask that question, you know, my answer is wherever we see our clients. So we want to have, we'd like our business, you know, if we're sitting at $4 billion now, we'd like it to be at $10 billion. But I'd like more than 50% of that growth to come out of the growth that we've achieved in our clients' assets rather than new assets. You know, we're a hungry business. It's always trying to go out there and get new clients. But there's, in terms of the life cycle of a business like ours, the first 5 years is, you know, a massive drive to get a critical mass of clients. We've now got an asset base where how we can grow our clients' assets is a bigger growth factor than growing the number of clients. So in the next 3 to 5 years, for me, instead of saying I want to get from 5 to 10, I would say, you know, I want our clients to grow their assets, and we want to give them investment returns of 10% plus in dollars over the next 5 years. And if we do that, our business grows dramatically. Our clients make a lot of money. And if we achieve that from an investment point of view, we'll typically get new clients. So it's investment return focused, but supplemented by, you know, to get to where we've got to, we've obviously a very, very motivated and effective distribution and new client acquisition strategy.
You're certainly describing a virtuous cycle there. Peter, we all know growth doesn't happen in a straight line. Talk to us for a bit about best days and worst days. What could you recall or would want to share with our audiences, and especially those who themselves are high growth organizations and all realizing it doesn't generally happen in a straight line. It's not always predictable. What could you share with them?
Yeah, so we listed our business quite early on in our lives. We obviously work and understand the listed market and capital markets. And it was a great way to gain credibility with clients, because being listed means that you've got, you know, very transparent forms of governance, and, you know, it's confirmation that they can trust a business that was quite young. So that worked for us extremely well. And, you know, some of our, in retrospect, the most harmful thing for our business, we listed it at 2 rand and it went up, you know, to 15 rand in a year. So the value of the business certainly hadn't gone up 7 times. And it was kind of in a bit of a small cap, positive run on the market and bull market. And we got caught up and we're the beneficiaries of that excitement. So, you know, those were certainly fantastic days to, you on the cover of the magazines as the great success story and look what they've done. But in reality, and if we look honestly, the market priced us as a share many, many years ahead of where we were, which then created some expectations which were pretty unrealistic. So, you know, that was an amazing feeling, and the confidence given by the market. We then, as part of our journey, our kind of core business has grown solidly and consistently over the course of 8 years. So, you know, if you look at our asset growth from naught 8 years ago, you know, we've kind of added on average 5 or 6 billion rand a year plus the market and got to a great place. But because we are listed and we're able to raise some capital, we made a few acquisitions. And we made one acquisition of a global emerging market hedge fund business sitting out of London, which about a year or two, and I think the excitement of that fed into our share price as well. And about 18 months after we bought that, the investment performance went really sour. And that had quite a big negative impact on the business and the share price. So facing, you know, we've landed up in a very successful place, but, you know, that getting to a successful place typically involves 7 successes and 3 failures. Yeah. So it was about, that didn't affect our kind of core anchor business. That was another business. But certainly took a lot of shine off our, for people who'd given us the faith of investing us in the stock market. So as you can see, the big ethos of our business is to exceed people's expectations and make them delighted with the returns. And inevitably in the investment game, you don't always do that. So yeah, lessons learned from that. We would never go and buy another investment business. So we invest in businesses that can bring clients and we'll invest their money. But I think what we learned was that we want to be in, we've got a certain way of investing, which has been very successful over time. And we're not going to go and buy or invest in a business with a different methodology or a different way of doing things. That's kind of the best and worst, I guess.
Peter, this was a really fascinating conversation. I kind of feel we could spend the next hour kind of delving into this a bit more. It's certainly a very rich history and a fascinating business that you and the team managed to put up. Thank you for the time you spent with us. Thank you for all the insights and delving into the psychology as much as into the logic of investing. Time well spent. Appreciate it, and I'm sure our audiences do as well. For those listening, we have a number of episodes coming up that are going to be focusing to Peter's earlier point, the role of technology, the way in which organizations are utilizing and leveraging technology to scale up their business, whether in the fields of financial services, in the energy sector, as well as in others. So stay tuned for those episodes. We'll publish the details on our website and on social media. Thanks again, Peter. It was absolute pleasure. Thank you for the time and really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Hey, Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.